This is a download from BFM 89.9, the business station.
BFM 89.9, welcome to the Morning Run. I'm Sharad Kutin. With me, Julian Ng. What a morning. It's Hump Day, Wednesday, and the 26th of April.
Yeah, Sharad. Thank you.
for a reminder
thank
that
you
you're
for that update.
That we're midweek. We have a lineup for you that will curl your toes, starting with a breakfast grill at Tan Chun Han. Speaks to Jonas Lind. He's the CEO of SilverTech. And SilverTech is a company involved in identity management projects, which involves personal details from cradle to grave, apparently birth certs, driver's license, passports, etc. And I guess, you know, in this day and age, with our identities freely available, you know, continually, I mean, the issue of data privacy, I think, is probably first and foremost in the minds of many people. To what extent can their identities be stolen?
Absolutely. I think it is only in Malaysia that this kind of business models can be stated with a straight face. I mean, if you try saying this in the United States, I'm sure you will raise a lot of eyebrows, you know, when you say that you're going to get a contract from the government to track identities in your country. That's bound to raise some concerns. But, you know, this is big business.
Yeah, you know, but let's look at India, for instance, and Narendra Modi's government actually pushing something similar to an identity card across a nation of over 1.4 billion people. The question, I guess, there are countries and cultures which, in which, as you say, this would be deemed an invasion of privacy. For others, you know, the argument would be that government needs this information to help direct development policies. It needs to chart what's happening because it's so heavily involved in the management of the economy and also people's livelihoods and welfare.
Yeah, that's right. In Malaysia, we are so used to the idea of an identity card, probably a throwback to, I guess, the communist era policies at that time, right? Having the need to identify your whereabouts. I think the British came up with that idea.
Yeah, so I guess it would be not so much the communist era, meaning that this was the era of the emergency, the period of the emergency
right.
With the so-called communist insurgency. And the identity card was resisted then, but of course it then became part of the new normal. But you're right, at the start it wasn't so easy to make people sort of give up power to the state, which is essentially what happens when we have these identification systems.
Yeah, and also in India, that case is very interesting because the ID project over there has been around for, I think, 5 to 10 years. At the very early stages, it had very noble intentions. I think right now also to implement it is something that the government and administrators of India felt that they need to do because the money wasn't finding its way to for its intended purposes for the people. Because when you want to give aid to, for example, farmers, they found that it was the middle people who took the money simply because the farmers did not have IDs, couldn't open a bank account, couldn't set all those administrative matters up. And a lot of leakages, and that wasn't the intended purpose of developmental economics over there in India. So it's a crucial project in India that they set this up, and I think this ID project in India would even have a very amazing economic consequences for the Indians.
Yeah, I think it's called the Aadhaar card, Aadhaar, and that's I mean, there's always this side, right? So you have to give up something of yourself in order to get something from the state, and some people are very clear that they don't want to give too much to the state, but others, you know, especially who are in need of state assistance, or maybe in this case have absolutely no choice. I mean, if you think of the demonetization project, in fact, what happened was, you know, in order to get change your money, you had to open a bank account. You know, for urban people, it meant also getting credit cards and using credit cards more extensively.
Yeah,
It's
such a cash-based economy. So I think that a lot of these measures are very good for the people over there. I think that, opening a bank account. Just imagine that, not having a bank account, how much, how crippling that is for you, either personally or in economy. But this is a kind of way of life for the Indians over there.
All right. So we're going to be having that. That's part of our breakfast grill. Tan Chung Han speaks to Jonas Lind, CEO of Silver Tech. Now, after the 8:30 news, we have on current affairs a look at Myanmar and its record. So it's been, of course, in some ways, and its prime minister been crucified by the Western media and of course, Asian media as well, for kind of not living up to many of its promises. Many of the promises, I think, projected onto it. So, you know, it's a difficult transition. People talk about Myanmar moving towards democracy, having transited. But as I understand it, it's a long process. You see this in many countries, including Indonesia, when it moved from kind of one man, you know, strongman rule with military backup to something like democracy, a vibrant democracy we see now. It actually took years of transition.
To what extent the economic prosperity of the region would change the political landscape of Burma or Myanmar is going to be a main question for Aung San, because you know, you want to make people rich so that they can divert their attention from politics. That's trickle-down economics, right?
Well, no, actually, you know, we see in many parts of the world, remember, I think in the 80s, when we looked at the East Asian tigers, the big question was the creation of the middle class would bring with it the demands of the middle class, and the middle class classes were demanding voice. They were demanding democracy. They were demanding...
That's right.
We saw that in Taiwan. We saw that in South Korea.
I was just asking a rhetorical question. I'm not saying that it would happen, because we still see pockets of non-democratic rule in many parts of Southeast Asia. But Indonesia is a fine example and offers some hope of where certain countries can go. It can go either way. I mean, look at a country like Thailand. They just got out of that military. Oh, they're still in there.
They just got a new king.
That's right. And I hope that this kind of economic development would reach into all walks of society. But I doubt it. You know, somehow there's just this lingering fear and concern in me that there are too many powerful people, too many people who are working behind the scene, you know, to entrench their and perpetuate their power.
Well, you know, very recently, Julian, in Bangkok, there was this incident where a plaque, or it was actually in the sidewalk, commemorating the 1932 revolution in Thailand, the one that abolished absolute monarchy, was removed, and in its place was a brass again plate that commemorated the Chakri dynasty, so the family that is now on the throne. And what's been fascinating is, because why did it happen? Who did that? Who took away that symbol of democracy and replaced it with the symbol of monarchy, an absolute monarchy?
So it was done clandestinely.
Yes, right. It was done in the middle of the night, apparently. But it's raised a lot of... In fact, it's gotten a lot of people talking about what happened in 1932. Why did the monarchy system, the system of absolute monarchy, end in Thailand? And what was the promise of the 1932 revolution, you know? And so a lot of if it was done by people who are pro-royal, they had inadvertently stirred up a discussion about the 1932 revolution as a result, and not necessarily, you know, galvanize the pro-monarchy forces in Thailand by this particular act of vandalism.
If you look at what the monarchy has done in Thailand over the past 1,500 years, I must say that they are extremely creative in reinventing themselves to the extent that it gave the Thai... Actually, just the past 50 years, not the 100 years, in the reign of King Bhumibol, how they have really put their place in Thai society and in the minds of Thai society. And I think that that's going to be also the template of how the plutocracy of the world is going to react to this rising populism, and some would say demagoguery as well. because they need to reinvent themselves to protect the kind of powers that they have, you know.
But if it could happen, you know, all those years ago, why can't it happen again? I mean,
no, I think that this perhaps in many parts of the world, this democracy is illusory. I think that you know, we are under a kind of plutocracy. We are still continue to be ruled by corporations who make us work not only 9 to 5, but in many parts of the world beyond that. And these corporations are not subject to the vote. So is it a democratic system? You know, that's the question.
Yeah, big questions. We always, every time we talk about Thailand, we mention this book and we promote it because we both read it and we both think it's quite very
fascinating.
The King Never Smiles, a biography of the late King by Paul Handley. Freely available in Malaysia and Singapore. Anywhere outside of Thailand, you can get this book.
Just don't take it through the Suvarnabhumi Airport. That's the only advice.
That might be unadvised. Okay, also in today we have the S&M show, and you have a guest, Julian, don't you?
Yes, it's Tu Chau Pha. He's the executive chairman of Notion VTech. And if you're an observer of the market, you'll notice that the stock has gone up from 40 cent to 1 ringgit 20 cent. You know,
That's threefold.
Yes, you know, a lot better than what many people would be able to manage of their own portfolio.
And beating the market hands
Beating down. The market, beating the obviously the crash of the ringgit, which has gone the other way, but this has gone upwards three times in the last 6 months. So we're going to check up with him on developments within his company as well as his observations about the market.
Okay, quick look at the news overnight. If you checked out this story, it's about flying cars, because the stuff of childhood children's movies, Chitty Chitty
Sci-fi.
Bang Bang. I don't even remember that. You're probably too young for that.
I remember it.
Well, Timothy Kung was at the panel, remembers it. He's, you know, like half my age.
That would say something. Also, you know, all the sci-fi movies, this is what we have been waiting for, because for all these decades, we have been cheated of our future, right? We don't see any flying cars.
The Jetsons. So the Jetsons are about to be real. Apparently, this project developing a flying car has been backed by Google's co-founder, Larry Page. So that's in the news. Also, lots of talk since we had the conclusion of the first round of the French presidential elections. The wife of Emmanuel Macron, a lot of interest because of the love affair starting with Macron as a 15-year-old with a woman 25 years his senior, right?
Okay, first of all, I'm not going to pronounce his name the French way because I don't know how to do it. I'm just going to say Macron. And secondly, wow. I can understand.
But the wow is interesting because when Trump came to power, when he came to the White House, he brought along with him a wife 24 years his junior, and nobody said anything about it. But when Macron goes, if he goes to the Elysee Palace or whatever they call it, you know, where the French president, as it were, resides, if he wins, because Le Pen, I think, is still in the game, he brings with him a wife of 25 years, his senior.
Who has grandchildren who's older than his children, older than him.
In fact, she has a child older, not a grandchild, but she has a child older than him.
Older than, that's fine. I think that's normal. Of course, this will ring the gender equality alarm bells. But the main question is when they started their relationship, right? He was 15. Is that a legal age in France?
I don't know about the French rules over that. You know, I think he had a very chaste kiss at age 15. But beyond that, nothing has come out in the reports. And I don't think this is being reported as a scandal. It's just being reported as something about the man who now the French have a choice.
It's France.
Well, I mean, I know we say that, right? I mean, I don't know what we mean by that, but I guess if you watch French movies, and you know, I watch quite a few French movies, you get a sense that the norms that you might imagine, say, in American films, just don't apply to French films. The sense of outrage, you know, the line that Americans draw on, you know, sexual morality, somewhat redrawn by the French. So we have that. We'll be back with more after this. BFM 89.9. BFM 89.9, welcome to The Morning Run, and that was Jumping Jack Flash by The Rolling Stones. Julian Ng and myself, Sharad Kutan, with you. Quick look, Julian, at some of the news items before we talk about Kuala Lumpur. Kuala Lumpur is also making the news somewhat in a recent survey on perceptions about the city. A little-known terrorist group apparently was responsible for the bombing in St. Petersburg, claimed about 16 lives recently, and they apparently were doing it to avenge military action by the Russian military in Chechnya. So, you know, that this is now emerged as the reason behind the bombing. What we also know recently, Julian, is that MI5, part of the British intelligence system, has been warning British politicians that their role in foreign wars also opens them up to increased terrorist attacks. And, you know, so we think of Britain's involvement in Iraq. That has also been there's been a kind of a blowback from that. Here. But, you know, I think it's fascinating that politicians continue not to see or refuse to see the links between their actions overseas and domestic terrorism.
Yeah, I think this also comes in the wake of the Chilcot report from last year that pointed to the fact that Tony Blair was wrong to go on the war on terror in Iraq. Very controversial report, and yet having no impact on UK political thinking, geopolitical thinking.
You know, back home, on the question of terrorism, there's this item in page 4, The Sun, this morning, and the headline reads, "Youth gets 13 years for supporting IS." And this is a 21-year-old food stall assistant. And much of the things that he did to get him into hot soup included being in possession of items related to IS or images related to IS on his handful. That itself was enough. The security system seemed to have found him on a Telegram group called Gaga Hitam, or Black Crow, and Amana versus Pass, according to this report. 13 years. That's an extraordinarily long time for a crime of holding possession of images.
Yeah, you know, this is this predates Donald Trump, right? And this is the kind of right-wing populism, fake news, demagoguery, whatever you want to call it, which is very surprising in this day and age, because a lot of the recruits I assume would be very young people, and they would have access to the internet for the kind of news that they can get, so that they're not influenced. But apparently this kind of thing still goes on. And I also read with interest how Jimmy Wales, who started Wikipedia, wants to now start a news website to counter the kind of fake news that's going on. So much. I don't know if people who join groups like ISIS or Al-Qaeda believe in those causes for which they were recruited, or were they just influenced? Because you can go out there and decide for yourself, right? What's fake and what's not.
This is true. I mean, I think there's some level in which we think that if we approach the issue of terrorism or whatever motivates us with, you know, rational discussions of what's actually happening in the world, if we perhaps, for instance, got everybody the right kind of information, that somehow they would not be attracted to these militant groups. But I don't know if that's necessarily true, because as we talked about just now, you know, when politicians go to war and actually harm people, that is material. That's, you know, no matter how much you spin it, as Tony Blair and George Bush spun it, I mean, they talked about Iraq, for instance, having weapons of mass destruction, which turned out to be fake. That was fake information used to justify a war against a legitimate government. And so, you know, in that sense, the realities of the world also are spurring people to join these militant groups, you know, and it's quite extraordinary.
It is, it is.
Okay, so coming back home, as it were, there is the question of how dangerous Kuala Lumpur is perceived. And there's a recent survey that suggests that we are seen as much more dangerous than we really are. And the survey was done by an air charter firm called Stratos Jet Charters.
I wonder why this firm is involved in this kind of survey, but perhaps we should find out later. But, you know, over the last few years, you can feel, I think it's quite palpable that Kuala Lumpur has become safer. Do you feel that, Sharad? I mean, it used to be that we didn't dare walk out alone late at night or allowed our women and children to...
What century are we talking about? I don't know what century you're talking
off,
about.
Rolled off the tongue. But, you know, till today, I think that I, you know, feel a sense of foreboding when we want to walk out at night. But over the last few years, I think those kind of sentiments had reduced, perhaps because of the rise in tourism in Kuala Lumpur. So it comes as a surprise to see a report like this.
You know, personally, I think of my neighborhood, which I kind of started living in about 6 or 7 years ago. We used to have a police pondo on the street, on one of the main streets, because of the number of thefts, snatch thefts. You know, we actually had guys armed, you know, with knives coming into restaurants and holding up the till in Section 17 PJ.
I don't think those things are deterrent. The pondoks are not deterrent.
But you know,
neither are all these security barriers that are set up around our residential homes, residential neighborhoods, right? I don't think those
but
things
are deterrents. But,
you know,
Julian, I must say, in my neighborhood, I don't know if that in particular was what caused the fall in crime, but there hasn't been that kind of incident in my neighborhood for many years. I had a break-in, and of course, we still hear break-ins in the neighborhood, but the intensity of it and the sense of safety, the, you know, concomitant sense of increased safety has risen just because, and maybe it's good policing in the neighborhood. It could be that. I mean, in your neighborhood, are there concerns about safety?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. I think that we always can't be too careful about the kind of precautions that we take. But I do think that the heightened security that have been employed by many neighborhoods in the Klang Valley has changed the texture of our neighborhoods. Perhaps it is time now to go beyond normal design features of our homes to include a kind of aesthetic security to it, you know, instead of trying to outsource that to, in fact, this, if the design is right, we may even reduce our reliance on foreign workers, on immigrant workers, right? So I miss the days when you could just walk out and you see your neighborhood as is, instead of being barricaded by barriers all around it. It's not too aesthetically pleasing right now. Sure.
Okay, so some of the quick facts. There are, this survey scores cities on a scale from 1 to 5, 1 representing not dangerous and 5 meaning dangerous. So this is where you have a gap between, say, perception and reality. Apparently, KL and Paris have the same murder rate at about 4.4 deaths per 100,000 inhabitants. But Paris scores 1.6 on the scale compared to Kuala Lumpur's 2.33 on the scale. So we seem to be a much more dangerous place than Paris is, which is quite shocking, I think. But that is at least the perception, and this is a snapshot more than anything else.
Yeah, I think Paris also covers a very big area, many, many districts over there. Perhaps, you know, we're talking about averages here.
Right, absolutely. Yeah. Could be. We're coming up to the first bulletin of the day, BFM 89.9. BFM 89.9, Sharad Kutan, Julian Ng, and The Morning Run with you from 6 to 10. We're now at 40 minutes past 6, and we're going to be talking about a really interesting initiative by Wikipedia's founder, Jimmy Wales. He's creating a new service, WikiTribune, but with a very specific intention, which is to battle the scourge of what is now being called fake news.
That's right. I think this is very interesting, and I don't know how Jimmy Wales is going to do it, if he's going to use Wikipedia as a template, i.e. to give us access into this website for free and with substantive enough news, because good journalism costs money. There are many journalistic templates around the world that is hidden behind a paywall, like, for example, the New York Times, Financial Times, even The Economist. When you want to access those news pieces, you have to pay for it. But I think he wants to either keep it free or still keep it ad-free. The ads, to a certain extent, can pay for the news.
So what are the motivations? What we understand is that because fake news and the rise of it, its importance and apparent role in something, you know, as recent as the U.S. presidential elections, seems to be a reason why he's getting into it, the deliberate viral spreading of misinformation, as it's said, as one of the reasons. Clickbait advertising models, as well as the fact that, you know, there is, on the positive side, an audience willing to pay for high-quality news. And he looks at the New York Times and Guardian subscription models as a reason to be hopeful that, in fact, there is a demand for accurate news.
So I think he is still quite ambiguous about how free it's going to be, because the original spirit of what he wants to do, as per Wikipedia, is for it to be ad-free and free to read as well. I'm not sure how he's going to incorporate a subscription-based model into that thing, but certainly it raises the point that you really, really need money to have good journalistic content. I think also the other thing is that he's transferring this idea of editorial selection from the news platform to the users themselves. The question, Sharad, I mean, we are in the news and we are very often in the position of curating news for our listeners, but he wants to do away with that. What do you think of that? Are people in a position to decide for themselves how to interpret the news that they're reading?
Well, you know, I think in some ways is the thing that we don't think of consciously, which is that we pay not just for the information that comes in a newspaper or a website, but actually the way they present the world to us. And this is where it gets really difficult, because people are often attracted to news sites that reflect how they think about the world. They're not attracted to news vehicles and platforms that challenge them on a daily basis about their, you know, core belief systems. So
there's a lot of confirmation bias going
on. Right.
You only read news that agree with you.
Yeah, and I think that that's part of the problem. I think it's a laudable attempt, and I'm, you know, for me, it's like we just need to, you know, try. We need to try to educate people, and not just the media itself. It has to be the education system. It has to be governments. And it has to be responsible political culture. But you know, one of the things, of course, that fake news is often related to, we know it's related to things like attempts to mobilize votes and such. If you remember that fake news of Pope Francis supporting Donald Trump that had been sent and had gone viral before the election in the U.S. I mean, to what extent it motivated any Americans, Catholic Americans, I don't know. But the other thing that's often talked about in connection with fake news is it's linked to terrorism. And so we actually put out a little poll for you this morning with the link to this story of Wikipedia's attempts. And the question is, will terrorism be defeated if everyone had factual news? And the options are yes, because it's a big factor. Yes, somewhat. And no, beliefs don't change. They don't change just because you present somebody with a different fact.
Mm-hmm. Yesterday, in the quest to be more neutral and to be more wide-ranging in what I read, you know, I want to do away with a lot of this confirmation bias, because I'm reading a lot of news from liberal websites. So I signed up to this website called, this blog actually, it's called Flat Earth Science and the Bible. FlatEarthScienceAndTheBible.wordpress.com, right? Which provides research to prove that the Earth is flat. To prove that the Earth is flat, there is apparently no South Pole, and they also provide you points and instances to prove to you that there is a firmament in the heavens in which contains the sun and the moon.
Okay.
So I think it's a very interesting...
I mean, you did this as a lark. I mean, you really truly want to understand somebody else's belief system. You know, honestly, I have a friend who's a performance artist, and his performance was taking on somebody's belief system for a year. So he became a Mormon for a year. He's an American performance artist. And the point was to truly immerse himself in that, not just as an intellectual exercise. He lived their belief system for a year. And he engaged with public discussions presenting the worldview that he had elected to join. And so, you know, and many of us don't, I mean, first of all, it's exhausting. Two,
it could be fun, depending on how you look at it.
It could be fun, you know, but your motivations, I mean, are you doing it because you want to challenge yourself? Is that the motivation, Julian?
I just want to find out whether the world is, in fact, round or flat. So that's why I joined this thing.
Okay, but you know, I frankly have come to the conclusion through many years of reading that the world is not flat, okay. And that I think the images...
Is there some confirmation bias then?
But no, I don't
is
think
that
so.
Is that fake
news? But you know what I can't prove? I can't prove when I speak to somebody who's a believer who says there is a parallel reality. And so, you know, many of the elements in the flat world thing that you talk about just now exist in this parallel reality, which I can't disprove. So for me, no amount of discussions about our landings on the moon and space travel and exploration and, you know, elements gathered from, you know, planetary exploration will change the belief system of somebody who says, no, there's a parallel reality. So there's no... The conversation, in some sense, ends there, Julian.
But also, it's quite fun and titillating to look into how people go about their research and justify their own arguments. I guess that's what we want if we want to have a wider breadth of what people are talking about.
So, you know, the MCMC has an anti-fake news initiative. It's called Sabananian, because you use the hashtag Sabananian
as
well.
Nifty.
Yeah, it is nifty. I believe also the anti-terrorism unit, the Ministry of Home Affairs, also... has been involved in an initiative to do what they call a counter-narrative. So this is a step up from the presenting of alternative facts, right? To kind of do fact-checking. Here's counter-narrative. So what is the narrative but a way we tell ourselves stories about the world? And it's the platform, as it were, in which all the facts kind of rest. And so for them, in order to change the minds of young people who've gotten to terrorism or attracted to or on the verge of, they need to give them a different narrative. For instance, that being modern and being part of the modern workforce is a rewarding issue, perhaps that imperialism doesn't exist and the wars that are going on in the world do not require us to become militants. Maybe you want to go and provide social services to aid war victims rather than become a militant taking arms against, you know, evil forces, whichever side of the divide you are. But is that counter-narrative in that instance?
Yeah, I think people always, especially those who are in power, always want a piece of your mind, which is why they want to control media organizations. So I'm very interested to see how this Wiki Tribune thing how it pans out, because I'm really an admirer of the Wikipedia model, because it shuns advertisements and it shuns a paywall and it makes this thing free. And I think that Wikipedia has become such a big part of our lives. Not that it is the end all and be all for new sources, but certainly it helps us get educated on very basic.
Actually, I use it, I think,
every day, right? We use it every day. You know, it has survived to this day without a commercial business model.
But, you know, I must admit, Julian, I'm one of those free riders. I don't, in fact, pay. I've never given money to Wikipedia.
Yeah, but that's...
Have you?
Yes, I have. But, you know, Jimmy Wales doesn't really compel you to give, although he does ask for donations once in a while when you enter the website, but there is no obligation.
Well, you know, just a quick look at Twitter and our Twitter poll: will terrorism be defeated if everyone had factual news? 17% say yes, because it's a big factor. 25% say yes to some extent, but 58% says no, because belief systems do not change. Well, you know, join us on the Twitter poll. Tell us what you think. You can always tweet us. You can also text us or WhatsApp us at 016-201-9000. That's 016-201-9000. Next up, we have the news at the top of the hour, but here's Every Day is a Winding Road by Sheryl Crow, BFM 89.9.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. To find more great interviews, go to bfm.my or find us on iTunes. BFM 89.9, the business station.